It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. In 2018, Milwaukee County passed an ordinance banning landlords from discriminating against applicants using Section 8 housing vouchers. But a recent investigation by Wisconsin Watch found that many landlords aren't complying, leaving low-income residents with limited options for housing, even after they've applied for and received rental assistance. Our next guest is a fair housing expert, and she's here to help us understand what legal protections there are for Section 8 recipients in Wisconsin and what it will take for Milwaukee and other counties to address housing voucher discrimination. We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you or your family use housing vouchers, or have you in the past? What was that experience like? Is it difficult for tenants receiving rental assistance to find housing in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica Sanders is the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what are Wisconsin's laws related to fair housing? So give us a quick lay of the land.
Sure. So here in Wisconsin, we're tremendously fortunate to have robust fair housing protections. Of course, we've got the Federal Fair Housing Act. We have the Wisconsin Open Housing Law, which is our state fair housing statute. And then across the state, we have a patchwork of city and county fair housing ordinances. And together, all of these pieces of civil rights legislation protect us from discrimination based on factors like race or disability or religion, national origin, and so forth. There's a list of, you know, about 18 such protected classes in the city of Madison alone. And in Wisconsin, there are three local jurisdictions that have built in protections for people who use housing choice vouchers. And those jurisdictions are Milwaukee County, Dane County, in the city of Madison. In those three places, under those three local ordinances, housing providers are prohibited from discriminating against families simply because they use a housing choice voucher.
So there are protected classes, as you spoke of, the race, religion, disability, the ones that you normally think of. One of the protected categories in Wisconsin is lawful source of income. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one we get asked all the time.
I bet.
So in Wisconsin, the category lawful source of income is intended to protect people from discrimination when they derive their income from sources other than employment. So for example, perhaps they get income from Social Security disability, mm-hmm. or child support payments or veterans benefits of some type. All of those are sources of income that a housing provider would need to consider when taking into account whether or not someone is eligible for their housing opportunity. At this point in time, lawful source of income at that state level is not interpreted in a way that includes housing choice vouchers. And that's why it's so critical that those three local ordinances I mentioned earlier do specify that protection.
So about those ordinances, and the Milwaukee County officials passed one in 2018, for example. What led to that, though? Like, did officials see that there was a need for this? What were the steps that led to all of that?
Sure. So in essence, the Housing Choice Voucher Program is our largest federal housing subsidy that helps people with low income achieve housing. However, the program has never reached its full potential. What the program was intended to do was give households a voucher that they could then take and use in any community they chose. They seek that a housing opportunity from a private landlord and pay for part of the rent with their voucher. So the idea was that this program would really help break down patterns of concentrated poverty as well as racial segregation. If people could transport this voucher, sort of use it as a passport to seek out housing anywhere they desired. And in reality, that has never proven to be what's happened. Unfortunately, voucher holders are still overwhelmingly concentrated in areas of high poverty. And so it hasn't been the ticket to greater opportunity that the program was intended to be. And so various, you know, city and county governments have taken a look at that and said, you know, one of the things that's a barrier for people who use these vouchers is when landlords won't participate in the program, when landlords just say, nope, I'm not going to take vouchers here. And so the impetus behind creating it as a protected class was really to help ensure that there was a level playing field, that people with vouchers had the same opportunities as any other renters to seek out housing in a community they wanted to.
Why do landlords resist this? Why is it, why do they resist renting to people with vouchers?
I'm not a housing provider, so I can only tell you what they tell me. But I think part of the problem is there are still a lot of myths and stigma around housing subsidies in this country. Mm-hmm. And we really see it as part of our goal to really break down those myths, to talk about how people who use vouchers can be fantastic tenants and neighbors. According to HUD data, voucher holders on average stay about 8 years in an apartment, so they can be long-term successful tenants. There are some administrative barriers to participating in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. You know, a housing provider needs to contract with the local housing authority. But by and large, housing authorities do what they can to minimize those barriers. I think part of the issue is just a lack of information. A lot of housing providers aren't familiar with the program, and we need a lot of education and advocacy to ensure that housing providers understand that, in fact, renting to voucher holders can be a fantastic business decision.
Thanks for explaining that, Erica. I appreciate it. What does housing voucher discrimination look like in practice?
Sometimes it can be extremely overt. Housing providers simply tell housing consumers, sorry, you know, I don't take Section 8. Section 8 is what the program used to be called, and it's still a commonly used term for the Housing Choice Voucher Program. In other circumstances, housing discrimination based on someone's use of a voucher can look a lot like other forms of discrimination, like discrimination based on race or disability or religion. And it can be very subtle. The housing provider might simply tell a home seeker, oh, sorry, you know, we don't have anything available right now. Or, you know, I'm sorry, you know, we're not going to have any two bedrooms available until April. There are a lot of different sorts of more subtle ways that housing consumers can be turned away from a housing opportunity.
In your experience, when you've talked with people who have housing vouchers, housing choice vouchers, are they aware that they're being discriminated against, or do they just kind of think this is the way it goes?
It happens in both ways. Many times people are aware that they were treated unfairly, but they don't know what their rights are. They don't actually know that they experienced a violation of the law. In some cases, people know they experienced discrimination that's illegal, but they need to hustle and just get a roof over their heads. They don't have time to file a complaint or pursue some kind of legal remedy. And again, in many cases, people are completely unaware that there is help available or where to turn. And again, they're sort of, when you have a housing voucher, you only have a certain amount of time in which to use that voucher and to get a lease. And so people are needing to just move on to the next steps in the housing search.
How much time do they have?
It can vary based on which housing authority people receive their voucher from, but generally it's 60 to 120 days. And in a housing market like we have right now, that can be tough. Our vacancy rates across Wisconsin, but especially in Metro Milwaukee and Dane County, have incredibly low vacancy rates right now, which makes finding that housing tough.
Take me through the process. If a rental applicant realizes or believes they've been discriminated against, how do they go about complaining about it? How do they report it?
Well, I certainly welcome calls to our organization. The Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council takes complaints from people who are concerned they've experienced discrimination based on any of the protected classes under law, including using a voucher, again, in Milwaukee County, Dane County, and the City of Madison. In some circumstances, we can investigate on behalf of our clients. We counsel our clients on what their different options for legal remedy may be. In the City of Madison, for example, there's a really fantastic government agency, the City of Madison Department of Civil Rights, that helps enforce the City of Madison ordinance. So there are a number of different paths people can take to achieve some kind of remedy. And I would also say that by and large, the vast majority of people who come to us with any kind of discrimination complaint are motivated both to stand up for their own rights and achieve some sort of remedy for the harm they experienced, but they're also highly motivated to prevent this from ever happening to anyone else. Most of our complainants are really humiliated and hurt and distraught about the discrimination they experienced, and they can't bear the thought of that continuing to go on for others.
Erica Sanders is the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. She's with us to talk about the laws surrounding the housing vouchers in Wisconsin and why they can be so difficult to enforce. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Have you seen an apartment ad that says owners will not accept Section 8? Have you ever been turned away by a landlord or property manager because of your status as a recipient? What questions do you have about illegal discrimination in housing? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Rob Ferret, right now we're picking up the conversation with Erica Sanders from the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council about efforts to ban housing voucher discrimination in Milwaukee County. And we would love to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Maybe you've navigated the rental market as a low-income or Section 8 applicant. We'd like to hear your experience. What kind of laws or protections would you like to see for renters in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, we talked a little bit about how people in Milwaukee and Madison can file a complaint if they think they've been discriminated against. What about other parts of the state, not in Milwaukee or Madison?
Well, we certainly take complaints from people all over the state based on state and federally protected classes. But as of this moment in time, if you live elsewhere in the state, there are no legal protections from discrimination based on use of any kind of rent assistance like housing choice vouchers. But we take complaints on, you know, race, disability, et cetera, statewide.
We have Paul on the phone with us now. Paul is from Madison. Paul, thanks for calling.
Hi there. I'm really appreciative of your hosting this discussion. It seems to me that landlords are, maybe not every landlord, but there are a lot of landlords that are breaking these rules frequently because it doesn't really seem like there's any consequences for when they actually break the law. I'd be really interested to hear if your guest knows about what could be the consequences for this. Is there ever a case where a landlord loses their ability to rent in a city after racking up so many violations?
That's a great question, Paul. Thanks for asking it. Erica, what do you know about that? Are there repercussions?
Certainly. So housing providers, for instance, in the City of Madison may have to pay civil forfeitures or fines to the City of Madison. They may have to pay monetary damages to the victim of discrimination to compensate them for both tangible and non-tangible forms of harm the victim experienced as a result of the discrimination. Sometimes housing providers can be required to provide affirmative relief, meaning they may have to market their property affirmatively to a broad cross-section of a community so as many people as possible are aware that housing opportunity exists. Housing providers can also be required to undergo fair housing training so they know what the law is and how to comply with it going forward. But generally speaking, rental housing is not a heavily regulated industry in the sense that, at least in Wisconsin, there's no certification or permitting process or licensure process that rental housing providers need to undergo. It's not like how real estate brokers who buy and sell houses are regulated, for instance. So there aren't as many guardrails on the rental housing industry as there are on, you know, mortgage lending or home sales or homeowners insurance, other parts of the housing industry.
We have Terry with us now calling from Madison. Hi, Terry, you're a landlord yourself. So what is your experience?
Well, I have rented to people using housing vouchers. As a matter of fact, I have one right now, a renter, using a housing voucher. And I have rented to people who don't use housing vouchers. I've rented to people who have sort of minimal paying jobs, but two or three of them. And people who have, you know, more higher paying jobs. And the people that I have rented to with lower paying jobs who would be, you know, considered, you know, marginally poor have often different housekeeping standards than I have. And when they leave me with piles and piles of trash. And they leave barbecue sauce down the walls, and they don't take care of the property. And I still, like I said, I have somebody that I'm renting to with a housing voucher right now. But I have been burned many times by renters who don't take care of the property.
Thanks for sharing that, Terry. Erica, what do you think about what Terry said?
I would caution housing providers from making any assumptions about who may or may not take care of the property well, pay their rent on time, be good neighbors to other tenants, and so forth. Anyone can make a lot of noise. Anyone may lose a job and lose their ability to pay rent. Being a messy home housekeeper isn't related to anyone's protected class status. I think the bottom line is that when housing providers are making business decisions about who to rent to, they need to be making those decisions based on the facts before them in someone's application and not assumptions about anyone's ability to be a good tenant just based on features of their identity, things like race or income, et cetera.
We have Amber with us calling from Edgerton. Amber, thank you. I know we only have a couple minutes left on the program, but I wanted you to be able to share your experience.
Yeah, I was on Section 8 for 16 years, and I was very aware of the stigma. So I actually, every place that I stayed, left it looking perfect just to prove them wrong. And when I spilled barbecue sauce, I would wipe it with a rag, you know. But anyways, but it was very, very, very helpful for me. I was a sole parent. My son's father was deceased. And it was a huge source of independence for me. I didn't ever have to fall on a boyfriend or a family member to have to stay with them. I was able to raise my child however I felt was safe. And was best for him, and I never got myself put into positions where I had to get into unsafe situations because I didn't have a place to live. I am no longer on it, but it gave me so much independence, and my son is so awesome now. He runs his own business. He's 21. He's got a ton of money saved in the bank. The program works. I never got discriminated on. It was awesome.
Amber, can I ask you how long you had to wait for a voucher to arrive?
So I applied in 2003, and I lived in Walworth County, and they had about a year waiting list then, but I actually got lucky and got on after like 7 months.
Okay. So not long at all. All right.
Yep.
That's great. Amber, again, thank you so much for sharing that. And Erica, I mean, Amber was only on the list for a few months, but some people have been on for 14 years or more. What's the average?
I'm not sure it varies a lot by metro area and how many vouchers are available in that metro area. But Amber raised a point I think really merits focusing on, which is we need to assess and think about, before we make generalizations, we need to think about who these vouchers help. Almost 30% of voucher holders nationally are senior citizens. A little over a quarter of voucher holders are people with disabilities who are not elderly. And nearly half of voucher holders are single parent families. This is about ensuring that people who are friends, family members, neighbors, all have a chance for that safe and stable housing that clearly benefited Amber and her son. The other point I need to make here is that fair use of vouchers and equitable treatment of voucher holders is a racial equity issue. In Metro Milwaukee, housing choice voucher users are overwhelmingly Black housing consumers. Roughly 83% of housing choice voucher users are Black. So when we discriminate against voucher holders or treat them as second-class housing consumers, it can have a racially disparate impact that I think most of us would agree only compounds racial disparities in our culture, in our economy.
Thank you so much for joining us, Erica. Truly appreciate you sharing that with us.
Thank you for having me.
Erica Sanders is the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. She joined us for a look at housing voucher discrimination when landlords won't rent to applicants receiving rental assistance, and how local laws and programs throughout Wisconsin could be strengthened to protect low-income renters. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Shereen Seewert in for Rob Ferret. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice released a report last week evaluating the police response to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, in May of 2022. The critical incident review identified a series of failures in training, communication, and leadership that made the tragedy last longer than it should have. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a press conference last week that the victims and their families deserved better.
The report concludes that had the law enforcement agencies followed generally accepted practices in an active shooter situation and gone right after the shooter to stop him, lives would have been saved and people would have survived.
The DOJ report was not a criminal investigation, but newspapers in Texas are reporting that a local grand jury is now investigating the police response to the shooting for possible prosecution. We're learning more about the police response in Uvalde and the lessons we can take from that tragedy to improve how law enforcement responds to mass shootings in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the response to the Uvalde shooting? What was going through your mind? And what questions do you have about what the police did and didn't do? How do you think police should respond to school shootings? What would you like to see change as a result of this investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metro State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. He is also co-creator and deputy director of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center, which studies mass shootings. He is the author of several books, including The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What stood out to you as the biggest takeaway from this DOJ report?
Well, there were several things, and I think it was hard to almost go back and reflect upon that terrible tragedy at Uvalde, which was, you know, about 18 months ago now. But some of the key takeaways, the word failure was used a lot. It was sort of the top headline for the report. And I think that really encapsulates what happened that day. But when you dive a little bit deeper into the report, and I think it's important to stress here that in sort of typical government fashion, this is a 575-page report. And so getting through all of that to really pull out what are the key takeaways for practitioners can be quite challenging. You know, if you are a police chief or a school principal, and you really want to learn from this document, you know, somebody handing you a 575-page book is really not the most productive. There is an executive summary, but I think what we really need to do is pull it apart, find those key pieces, and move forward. And so with that being said, for me, here's the key thing. The document describes that officers didn't understand the magnitude of the incident. They didn't truly appreciate that this was an active shooter situation. They actually thought it was a hostage situation. Mm-hmm. And that is what shaped their response. There was then difficulty communicating between commanding officers and the officers on the ground, and also a breakdown in communication between the federal, state, and local agencies that responded, to the extent that they didn't realize who had actually showed up on the scene because so many officers had self-dispatched to it. And in the end, there was about 400 officers on the scene for this, but never were they really comprehensively accounted for, and they certainly weren't coordinated or led in a strategic way. And I flag all of those things because this sounds incredibly similar to another tragedy that happened 20 plus years ago. When you think about 9/11 and the 9/11 Commission report that followed, which documented exactly these same types of failures, that the magnitude of the incident was unforeseen and that it was underappreciated. There was a difficulty with communication. People were self-dispatched. There was a lack of leadership and so on. And it makes you wonder, why haven't we learned from the lessons of the past when we are dealing with these serious tragedies now in the present and then looking ahead to the future?
It can be difficult to criticize law enforcement in a situation like this because they're still putting their lives on the line to try to stop a shooter. So how do we balance the need to learn from these incidents with the risk of vilifying or being too harsh on the officers involved, who are people? They're people.
Oh, absolutely. And policing is one of the toughest jobs out there. And in my role as a university professor, our university is a major training hub for law enforcement. We work very closely with police officers on a daily basis in getting them recruited into the profession and then their professional development as they move through it. And so I deeply appreciate the challenge that presents. I think in this situation, though, these were not just individual errors. These were more systemic errors in the way in which this event was approached by officers and then the coordination on the ground as well. And there's several recommendations from this DOJ report about the need for additional training for officers in the event of these tragedies. And then dealing with simple things like inoperable communications and so on. And that goes beyond just the bravery or the decision-making of the individual officers. Because you even look back at Uvalde, you could see individual officers were actually wanting to do things differently and get in and approach the situation differently. But they were being held back and hamstrung by the policies and procedures on the ground and the lack of coordination and communication, particularly from what was meant to be leadership in those situations. And so I think that's where we should really focus our attention to ensure that that doesn't happen again.
We have Duane with us on the phone now. Duane is calling from Westfield. Hi, Duane.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
This has been something that I've, ever since these shootings have been going on for decades, I've yet to hear one person from government, I don't care who it is, anywhere from the state governor to the president, nobody, as much as we like to sit there and point fingers even at the police department and how things are going, we got to take some kind of proactive and try to get this done. And there was an actual way that you can kind of do it, because if you look at it in the long run, as much as we want to save everybody, we can't. So the best thing I've come up with, and I'll tell you this right now, is the most logical and the most easiest way to do it, and people will come out of there alive, is you know that people buy, or there's backpacks and stuff that kids can buy that are like bulletproof for $200 and so on and so forth. These companies that make that type of material and stuff, all they've got to do is sit down with the governor and make like drapes that go from window to window all the way across the room. They get a double, I mean, they make the doors a little bit more bulletproof. So if something is an active shooter, they hit it, they automatically lock it, they hit those down, and the kids will be all safe in a room until the police department gets there and they try to take care of the shooter.
All right, Dwayne. Thanks for asking about that. James, what do you think about Dwayne's suggestions?
Well, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. I think on the one hand, we could say that events like Uvalde should have never happened in the first place. And I do agree with this idea about being much more proactive and preventative in the work that we do. But I don't know if that necessarily always is translated into things like bulletproof doors or backpacks and so on. I think we also need to do a much better job of looking for the warning signs of people with violent intent and getting them connected to the help and the services that they need, getting upstream of these issues so that a gun never goes off in a school in the first place. I think there's a second thing that's also referenced very clearly, which does speak almost directly to your caller's point here. In the Uvalde report from the DOJ, it's observation 16 in the report, if anyone's interested in checking this. It talks about how lockdown procedures are predicated on the idea of a locked door, impenetrable doors and walls, and other physical security that did not exist at Robb Elementary. Now, what's interesting about this is it follows up with a recommendation saying that in this particular case, what you had is teachers, staff, and students locking down in their classrooms. But the school shooter had such a high-powered rifle that it was penetrating block walls. In fact, some people were shot through the walls. And that they actually recommended that the students should not have locked down inside the classrooms. Instead, they should have been educated to evacuate from the building, and that would have been safer in these scenarios. I think the key here is thinking about the particular dynamics on the ground of these events, and it's about getting people to safety as quick as possible, and perhaps locking down in a classroom when the shooter is in there with you and when they're using a high-powered rifle is not the best option and the best solution.
You've been studying this for a long time. What are some of the best practices in law enforcement to respond to a mass shooting like this?
Well, again, it comes down to that idea of getting upstream. So in the policing world, there is something known as threat assessment, which is a coordinated and collaborative approach to working with schools and school districts so that when there are risks or threats of violence, they are thoroughly investigated, and that law enforcement works in partnership with the community to identify an appropriate response. When we've studied these issues, we've often noted that a school shooting like this is intended to be a final act. And what we mean by that is those that perpetrate a school shooting, they get to a point in life where they no longer care if they live or die. These are individuals who are in a true existential crisis, and they're taking out that grievance on the school and the people inside it. And they intend to die in the act. And so when we think about the traditional role of law enforcement as just mitigating casualties or deterring violence because they're armed and they're in a security role, that perhaps misses the psychology of these events, which is to say that if we can give people a reason to live up front, and if we can divert them off of that pathway to violence so that they don't want to go to school armed with the intent of harming others, then we can save so many more lives. And that's really what that threat assessment work is about. It's about working in partnership, to give young people, because school shooters tend to be school children or people with some relationship with that school building as a current or former student, giving them an off-ramp and giving them opportunities to never have to perpetrate those crimes in the first place.
We're talking with James Densley from the Violence Prevention Project Research Center at Metro State University about a new report from the Department of Justice about the failures in the police response to the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your biggest takeaways from the response to the Uvalde shooting? How do you think police can avoid these same mistakes in the future? And what questions do you have about law enforcement practices for mass shootings? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with James Densley. He is a criminal justice professor and co-creator of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center at Metro State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's with us today discussing a new report from the Department of Justice analyzing the failures in the police response to the 2022 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. We'd like to hear from you, too. 800-642-1234. What do you think about this report on the police response there? What questions do you have for our expert? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We talked earlier about the need for additional training as something that really came out in this report, James. Is that something you think local departments, local police departments across the country will really pick up on?
I do hope so. And I also hope that the training that is done is high quality, that it's done with fidelity, and that it's done in a way where there can be some evaluation so that we can see that the training is effective and that people are truly learning what needs to be learned in that training. So I think the training can take multiple formats. On the one hand, there has to be training around the immediate response if an active shooter event is occurring. And that will often be done, you know, where you're replicating the real life scenarios that will be occurring. But at the same time, there needs to be training around some of the basic sort of command staff communication to ensure that everybody knows who their roles and responsibilities are in the event of a tragedy like this. And that also speaks to things like the reunification plan and also the way in which we treat families and victims and other community members. One of the things that was stressed in the Uvalde report was just how poorly some of the students in the school and some of the families who had lost loved ones were treated by law enforcement in terms of their access to communication, their access to care and support. And if we can proactively prepare for this, we don't get those gaps in communication and information that parents are crying out for. And parents can feel like they're being treated with dignity and respect. And so it's not just the practical aspects of this, it's also around communication and coordination, which is so important when it comes to being public-facing and serving the community.
We have Lance with us now from Ashland on the phone. Hi, Lance. What would you like to know?
Well, it's not so much I'd like to know, but I'd like to agree with the speaker. I mean, I can't agree with him more, you know. I mean, it's communication. It's called readiness. It's called education. It's called making people aware. And, you know, I think that's what has to be done, you know. People have to be made aware, you know, even though it's a tragedy what's going on. But if we're aware, there might not be so much death. There might not be so much misery.
And thanks, Lance. And what do you think, James? I mean, how difficult is it, though, to have that preparation, that education, that, you know, to that outreach?
Well, I think your caller speaks to an important aspect of this, which this is really a public health campaign to some degree. It's every parent's worst nightmare that a tragedy like this would occur in a school building, or for that matter, in any public space. But we do have to be prepared for that. And I think for too long, we felt like preparation was, as long as we run a run, hide, fight drill, and that we put an armed resource officer or a metal detector in a building, then we're going to be safe. And really what it's more about is that some of this begins at home. And it goes back to what I was mentioning earlier around looking out for those warning signs, that if you are concerned about somebody who may be demonstrating some sort of violent or suicidal ideation, maybe we can reach out and get them connected to the help that they need. If somebody is unhealthily obsessed with school shootings or is in the process of procuring firearms, which is sort of unlike them, particularly if they are young people, these might all be warning signs that there might need to be some sort of intervention. So it's about all of us being part of the solution and working together to solve the problem. It's not all on the backs of law enforcement, but we can all be part of this. And I think that comes from the awareness that your caller mentioned. If we're all aware and we're all proactive in that, if you see something, say something, then we can avoid these tragedies.
I'd like to go to Rhonda from Menominee on the phone. We have about 3 minutes left, but I wanted to make sure to take your call. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. I heard in the report a couple of things that were disturbing. One was that possibly the school doors were unlocked, and even though they spent so too many minutes looking for keys, which is unreal, the number of minutes, 70-some minutes they wasted, looking for some keys, that the door was really unlocked. And two, they treated the situation as a barricade situation when they should have treated it as an active shooter situation. Sure. Totally different.
Thanks, Rhonda. And yes, James, you talked about that a little bit earlier, how they mischaracterized that. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think Rhonda's absolutely correct here. That was one of the most striking things. A lot of it came down to the lack of communication, that people just weren't getting the information they needed. And in some cases, that was simply because they were relying on personal cell phones instead of a coordinated radio response unit to get the information to the people who needed it, which is pretty shocking. And then something as simple as trying to find a key or determining whether or not a door is locked. I mean, many schools have centralized locking mechanisms and computerized systems. There's a lot of technology now that could avert a lot of this. So again, it all comes down to that idea of coordination and communication as being key with solving these problems. If people knew what they needed to know and they knew it in a timely manner, I think the response would have been completely different. And that really is the key takeaway from this report. It's all about communication and it's all about coordination. And that's how you deal with these issues on the ground.
We have about a minute left in our time together. Just a final question for you. Have you found areas for hope or optimism when it comes to these issues of gun violence in America, or is this something we're going to just be dealing with forever?
You know, I absolutely have. We outline this in a lot of detail in our book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, where we've actually interviewed survivors of shootings. We've interviewed first responders. We've even interviewed victims' families, perpetrators, and averted shooters. And that's where the hope comes from. Sometimes we think it's a really big thing that has to happen to divert somebody off of the pathway to violence. But actually, we've learned it can be very simple things. Giving people hope, giving people a reason to live, that can be enough to get them off of that pathway, that they don't go ahead and perpetrate these crimes. And that's where I get the most hope, looking ahead for the future.
James, thank you so much for joining today and sharing your perspective here.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
James Densley is a criminal justice professor and co-creator of the Violence Prevention Project Research Center at Metro State University in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was with us today discussing the Department of Justice's new report on the failures of the police response to the 2022 elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, selling real estate has ups and downs. Two agents in Northeast Wisconsin talk about getting into the business, earning a living, and the current market conditions. Also, a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin discusses her new guidebook. It all happens tomorrow on The Morning Show after 7 o'clock. Saturday was National Cheese Lovers Day, an opportunity to appreciate the history and cultural significance of Wisconsin's favorite food. To see which cheeses people love the most across the country, one company looked at what type of cheese residents in each state search for the most. Their analysis, if search volume really is a reliable metric, showed that Wisconsinites overwhelmingly love cheddar cheese. But back when my son was a first grader, he insisted that cheddar was delicious, but he also said it was the most dangerous type of cheese. More dangerous than Swiss, Gouda, or Brie, he said. His reasoning? Cheddar is sharp. Cheesy, I know. This is Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the legalization and rise in popularity of sports betting in the U.S. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about the tricky act of baking a loaf of bread.
The simple, wholesome act of baking a loaf of bread can fill your kitchen with warm aromas and quiet your mind. That is, unless you're writer B.J. Hollers. For him, it's a little more complicated.
Every now and again, on some late November dawn, as the ice crackles along the kitchen window, I find myself drawn to the leisurely pursuit of baking a loaf of bread. Not by hand, but by following the bread machine's foolproof step-by-step instructions. I measure flour, water, sugar, and dry milk into their proper portions, and then, as instructed in step number 8, use two fingers to create a small well within the bread machine's mixing barrel, into which I pour 2 teaspoons of yeast. Shut the lid, press start, and 3 hours later, I've got bread. But on this morning, 3 hours later, all I've got is a problem. In my burst of baking zeal, I'd forgotten to insert the mixing blade into the bottom of the bread barrel. The result? A sludgy pile of unmixed dough that neither looks nor tastes like bread. Grumbling, I dump my muck and prepare to start anew. I reach once more for the flour, only this time, having squandered most of it, I fall far short of the necessary 4 cups. No matter, I think, I'll simply drive the mile to my parents' house to borrow a bit of theirs. Upon my arrival, I decide not to wake them. Instead, I cat-burgle my way through their front door, silently rifle through their cabinets, and discover their own meager flour supply. I steal all of it, but that still leaves me 2 cups short. No matter, I think, I in the shortfall, I'll simply text my neighbors asking if I might borrow a few cups from them. Within minutes, they reply that regrettably they are out of town, which I realize is not the same as not having any. I briefly consider cat burgling their home as well. What's one more B&E alongside the rest? My quest continues at the gas station, where, in desperation, I purchase a $5 bag of flour. Now, flush with flour, I attempt to restore order to the universe by cat-burgling my way back into my parents' house, this time to return the stolen flour. The task complete, I return home so that I might begin again the leisurely pursuit of baking bread. I whirlwind through the instructions, and then, while lost in the hypnotic churning of dough, I consider the many humiliations I've endured before breakfast. How I managed to turn a 1-second oversight into an hour-long adventure that cost me more time and money than any loaf of bread could ever be worth. The irony is that I have no need for bread. Our bread box overflows with more multigrain and split-top wheat than any carb-loving family could ever enjoy. Had I done nothing this morning, I'd have managed a more favorable outcome. any number of aphorisms might speak to my failed baking experience. Measure twice, cut once. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And on the subject of stolen flour, possession is 9/10 of the law. But the lesson I most need is the one I'm most reluctant to hear. How, in my attempt to engage in some societally agreed upon leisurely activity, I'm left more anxiety ridden than ever. Until people like me learn to start viewing leisurely activities as an essential part of life rather than an indulgence, we risk falling victim to another aphorism: burning the candle at both ends. I can't help but feel some kinship with that bread machine. Both of us are hell-bent on trying to reap a reward through constant churning. Yet on this fateful morning, after 3 hours of bread machine surveillance, I notice something new. The mixing blade churns intermittently rather than continually, meaning that for the bread to rise to its full potential, it requires both motion and rest. Work has its place, but so must leisure. The recipe calls for both.
B.J. Hollers is a writer, author, and assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now on Central Time, sports betting is now legal in some form or another in 38 U.S. states, including Wisconsin. And with the 2024 College Football Championship wrapped up and the NFL playoffs in full swing, gambling opportunities have been abundant. Our next guest studies the cultural impacts of sports betting and is here to talk about how recent trends in gambling have influenced the sports world. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever participated in sports betting, either formally or under the table? Did you put money on the Packers game last week? What do you think about the widespread legalization of sports betting in the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jason Lopez is an assistant professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. He's currently working on a book that explores games around games, including fantasy sports, sports betting, and sports video games. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So to what extent is sports betting legal in Wisconsin? What does Wisconsin law actually permit?
Well, when it comes to sports betting, there are locations where you can physically go in there and make bets, but we do not have any apps that are able to be used for the game. Which is different than other states where it might be legalized. You could maybe place a bet on a DraftKings or a FanDuel or something.
Why is in-person or retail somehow more acceptable than mobile internet in the eyes of the law?
Well, I mean, I think it's just kind of dependent on the state and what they feel comfortable with. It's hard to say exactly, you know, what goes into the legislative process, but
sure.
each state does indeed have to draw certain lines. So, for instance, where you can play, how you can play. I know, for instance, in Oregon, you can't bet on college sports. So, you know, each state has to for themselves come together because, you know, the federal legalization just says each state can decide for itself. So then the question is, well, what now? And so each state then has to pick what the game can and maybe should look like.
Why was sports betting banned in the first place? What are some of the concerns that center on that?
That's kind of a long and complex story, but part of the story, at the very least, involves skepticism with bookmakers and the act of bookmaking, which bookmakers are the ones who sort of set the lines and take your money and give your money back, hopefully, if you win. And, you know, bookmaking is sort of the art of doing that. And there was a lot of skepticism about the game and its fairness and, you know, the role of these people who are the bookmakers and, you know, their relationship to their customers. And so there was a lot of backlash against them that made it so that eventually they outlawed it. But that still left room for other kind of gambling that did involve a bookmaker to still kind of be around and be in existence. So, you know, betting on horse races, for instance, is legal in many states where sports betting is illegal. And that's because the system is different. There's no necessarily like bookmaker. And we can talk more about that if you would like. But
yeah,
even think about about daily fantasy sports, which is a form of gambling, but is legal around it. But again, no bookmaker. So it started off with sort of a skepticism of that role, and then kind of just shut down for many years until recently.
So what did sports betting look like when the federal ban was still in place?
Sports betting in particular, well, so just because it was banned, as we all know, that
it didn't mean it didn't happen, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it still was a vibrant culture. But some of the stuff that I work on in my book and through some of my research is the idea that sometimes people like to think about sports betting as something that's sort of separate or other from sports or sports fandoms or sports cultures, but they're actually pretty closely tied together. And so even though sports betting was largely illegal in the United States, it was still a very popular way that people would engage with sports. It was very accepted and normalized within those groups. And so just even though it was illegal, the kind of cultures looked very close to what we see today in the legalized version. You know, it's a good way of rooting on your team sometimes, or, you know, something of the sort. So very similar, the cultures were, I would say.
Do you feel like sports betting is more popular now, or are we just seeing it more?
I think it's both.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, to gamble in the illegal fashion involves having, you know, kind of knowing what you're doing and how to get access to the game. It either involves, you know, you like making a bet with a friend, or, I mean, even though that's not illegal, but, you know, mm-hmm. making a bet with a friend, or, you know, finding a bookmaker, somebody who would like take your money, you know, maybe at like a bar, somebody you would gamble with through the phone, or, you know, gambling with offshore accounts. So, it requires a special knowledge, and so that could be a barrier for some people playing. So I think opening it up and making it legal makes it so that certainly more people are playing. However, on the other hand, it was a vibrant culture, and we are seeing it more because it has become legitimized, and it's sort of coming out of the shadows because, you know, now we see things like, you know, it's on ESPN, and people will openly talk about it during broadcasts, and so it's definitely become normalized in a way. So I think, to the answer to your question, it's actually both.
I'm curious about the sports gambling that you see at just about every corner bar in Wisconsin. I mean, you go in there and there's money being placed on pools. Mm-hmm. Is that legal?
I'm not a legal scholar, and I definitely don't want to be on like radio mm-hmm. and saying what people can and can't do. I actually do not know the answer to that question. But I really like you bringing that up because it's that is gambling too, and that shows that is one of those ways in which gambling is normalized in sports culture and in sports fandom. You know, anytime you'd have a Super Bowl pool where you pick squares mm-hmm. or have a fantasy team that has money on it, like that is gambling. It was just normalized gambling. So what we have legalized now in many states is just a kind of game that's a very particular version of wagering on sports.
We're talking with Jason Lopez, Assistant Professor of Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison, about the popularity and influence of sports betting since its legalization. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin should legalize mobile and online gambling in the state? Do you have concerns about widespread sports betting? Have you ever won or lost a significant amount of money on the outcome of a sporting event? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Jason Lopez, Assistant Professor of Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the legalization of sports betting in the U.S. and the impact it's had on the sports world. You can join in, 800-642-1234. If you like to gamble on sports, what do you like about it? What platforms do you use? Do you place bets on sports while the federal ban was still in place? Call 800-642-1234. Don't worry, we won't tell. 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jason, which sports are the most heavily betted on? Bet upon. I'm not saying it correctly. Bet. You know what I'm saying.
I totally get it. It's for American sports. It's football, both college and professional. In fact, that's a lot of where a lot of the gambling structures and the gaming structures we see developed out of that. But we shouldn't underestimate the early role of sports like baseball and basketball. A lot of gambling cultures grew as those sports were growing as well. And then, of course, if we want to look back even further, horse racing and boxing.
Okay. You mentioned Oregon doesn't allow betting on college sports. Is that correct?
Yeah. As far as since I've checked, but yes, the state does not allow gambling on college sports.
Do you know what the reasoning for that is?
I mean, it's kind of I do not know. I wasn't like there. I didn't see the hearings or something like that.
Sure,
but I would assume that a lot of it probably revolves around concerns that people have, like generally about sports and gambling's like influence on the sport. I think that sometimes there's even like kind of even despite the fact that it's legalized now, kind of a concern about getting money involved in fandom and cheering is also kind of seen as like uncouth or not true fandom, I think, in some circles. And so I think it's both hesitancy about the influence of you know, having money around college athletics, but then also maybe on the other hand, the idea that it, you know, kind of like ruins what college sports are supposed to be. But I haven't heard any like politicians speak out about it, but those are some of the common concerns that people have around gambling about, you know, mm-hmm. younger people's games.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about how legalization of sports betting has influenced the sports themselves. What's the impact been?
Profound.
Really?
And from the very beginning, it has been profound. And part of my work is kind of telling a little bit of that story about how sports and sports media and sports gaming have all kind of grown together and developed together and responded to each other along the way. I think it's common for people to kind of think of these as maybe three separate entities, but there's a way in which they were always in conversation and developed with each other and were dependent upon each other. And I think you can see this in a myriad of ways.
Can you give an example of how sports betting has influenced sports?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite cases to talk about is something that feels really natural because it's around sports all the time, and that is the injury reports. And so some professional leagues will mandate that players or teams, or you know, sometimes the leagues themselves will play a role in this, disclosing what's going on with a player's health and you know, whether they'll, you know, be likely to miss games or how many games or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And as everyday sports fans, we are like accustomed to like hearing this information and trading in this information. But if you start to think about it, if you're just a fan of a team, I guess, you know, like say the Lakers, you might want to know whether LeBron James is playing or not. And if he's not, how long he's not going to, that just might be like information you would like to know. But that information is crucial to gamers and gamblers in particular, because they're going to want to know, they're going to want to predict what's happening. And if you don't know who's on the court or the pitch or the field, your predictions are going to be off. And so the leagues don't have to disclose that information. You could imagine a league just saying, we're not going to give up our players' personal information, but they do. And one of the main reasons for that is because it enables this kind of gambling, or gaming, I should say.
Okay. We've got about 4 minutes left, but I want to go to the phone. Kevin from Janesville is with us. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I just wanted to note one benefit and two potential drawbacks from legalization of sports gambling. The benefit would be protecting would-be gamblers from apps that are kind of shady, that circumvent the laws. And two drawbacks would be the advertising for gambling has gotten kind of loud relative to that of the sport, so potentially drowning out the sport or affecting the culture. And then another drawback would be if an official or a player involved themselves in gambling, and that could cause a scandal. And I will mute before my dog starts barking too much.
Thank you, Kevin. All right. Well, Jason, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that there was a lot in there, and I hope that puppy's doing okay. Sounds awesome. But yeah, I think those are very common concerns about gambling. I'll just kind of maybe pick a few things in there to just quickly follow up on. I really like the point about you see these ads everywhere, and it is kind of like, you know, choking and drowning out a lot of other forms of sports media and like other ways of engaging with sports. And I think that's right. But that's because it just got legalized, and therefore you're having all these companies trying to get people involved and kind of have them become, say, MGM players or ESPN players or DraftKings players. And so, like, you know, this is kind of like an opportunity to like grab people. And so, yeah, that's definitely happening. And I'll just remind people that this also happened around the daily fantasy boom, when all of a sudden companies like FanDuel and DraftKings started offering a daily fantasy, a legalized way of gambling on fantasy. Ads were everywhere. You couldn't escape them, and it was for similar reasons. And so, yeah, I think for some people that is a major drawback.
Yeah. We got an email from Kevin, a different Kevin, curious about the outlook on full legislation of sports gambling in Wisconsin. Do you have a sense of whether there is support in the legislature for this? He said he currently drives down to Illinois or Iowa to make bets on NFL Sundays.
Yes. So that behavior is extremely common. So I can't tell you about the local politics here. I'm just like, that's just out of my purview. I'm sorry. I wish I could help you out there, Kevin. I'm sorry. But I will say that for everyone else, that the idea that having the game be largely unavailable in Wisconsin makes it so that people will indeed travel to other states in order to gamble, and therefore, you know, spend their money in, you know, in other economic systems. And that basically is just as basically as old as the game itself and gambling itself. It is commonly the case that once some state or region opens up gambling and legalizes it, it will commonly siphon people from the surrounding areas, which then will occur like a domino effect where it widespread legalization starts to happen. And so, again, without knowing the political situation going on here in Wisconsin, it is notable that there are two close by neighboring states that have it legalized, and I would guarantee that there are a lot of people like Kevin who do indeed just drive over the border in order to place a bet or two.
In our last 45 seconds or so together, is match fixing a concern with this, with the rise of sports betting?
Yes, it always is, but it always has been too. Remember, gambling is profound and has been always something that has been engaged with sports. So, yeah, it was always a worry, and I think it's still a worry now. I will say that often case scandals, fixing scandals, will be caught by sportsbooks. And so there's a way in which they're kind of sometimes a check on their own business and their own threat to the fairness of sports.
Well, Jason, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Jason Lopez is an assistant professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We talked with him about the impact of gambling on the sports industry and what's next for Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, journalist and author Tim Alberta discusses his new book, The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, detailing the American evangelical movement through the eyes of preachers, televangelists, and ordinary churchgoers. That conversation and much, much more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.